Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is 9:00 on February 7th, 2023, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of the Commission. To my right is Commissioner Sid Logan, Vice President. To my left, Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary. John Harlow, CEO, General Manager at the main desk there. Sean Arano, Interim General Counsel. Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director. Jenny Ridge, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stoltzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with the PUD staff. I'll now turn this over to our CEO General Manager, John Harlow, who will facilitate the discussion. Good morning and welcome, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. We've got lots of good stuff on the agenda this morning, so we will get right at it. And first up is our corporate communications star, Julie Cunningham, with our media.
Trust me, not the star. One of, just the leader of real stars. Without them, we would have not much of nothing. So
you have a constellation.
Yeah, there you go. I enjoy my constellation a whole bunch. They bring us good things. So starting with, we had lots of good press out on our rate increase. It got covered well. We were in the Everett Post, by Edmonds News, Cairo, the Edmonds Beacon, and the Everett Herald. So we got things in all through the county about it. So I thought that was very positive. And that's one of those things that J.D. Power says, get your news out when you're having different things about your rates. So,
was there a story in the Herald about
it? I think, well, maybe.
I've been looking for it.
Okay. I think it's a note on their blog. Yeah, I'm looking at that and I was like, wait.
So I brought a copy of the Edmonds Beacon article. It's excellent. And our editor, Brian Sargle, is credited with writing it, but I'm sure that all the information came from us.
Yes.
From you.
Thank you.
And it was very well done. It was just very clear.
Aaron worked with numerous people around the district, the ELT members, and Brian before he left, and that came out really well. So. Got good coverage, and it's my evidence that was on.
Yeah, no, I saw that.
Gold Bar, we've shut down Highway 2 for a couple of days. Our crews did wonderful, and we got coverage on that on Como and in the Everett Herald for that. And we really, the bonus on that is we met and got to know the PIO up at Stevens Pass ski area from this. So there's all sorts. I told Kelly, go, come on, try for some, you know, nighttime tickets or something for us. Yeah, something going there. But it was important we meet with them because we needed skiers to come off the mountain early if they were coming down, or rather, otherwise they were going around. So had some good conversation with them through this need. Scott Gibson worked with Adachi to write a story about how transportation and energy storage are putting us on a path to carbon neutrality. So that's excellent, kind of message we like to get out. WSU's student newspaper covered us on our work being done to design a microgrid project between the utility and the Tulalip tribes. And that's fun. We haven't had something in the WSU paper, I think, for a month. We might have in the past, but not for quite some time. We had articles in local and trade press welcoming our new general counsel, Colin Wellenbrock. It was at least in Snohomish talk locally and then in some of our, like, NWPPA and those things. This one's really fun. Solar Washington's newsletter did a nice Q&A interview with Susie Oversby. So it was their member spotlight with Susie. So she keeps this always out in the news in positive ways. And our work on clean transportation from chargers to bus charging infrastructure is mentioned in a Herald article on clean transportation, decisions on light rail buses, and more loom in 2023. That was in the Herald. Then coming up, we are working with excuse me, the City of Everett about the Edgewater Bridge being closed down on Mucklefield Boulevard. I watched that one really close. I live two blocks from that doggone bridge, so I'll be going a long way around to go anywhere south for a year. And Garrison is meeting with the Herald reporter to talk about our IOP. We're hoping it results in an article that follows up on the one in December and does a nice little teaser for our IRP open house that is coming up. So lots of things going on. We're off to a good launch for the beginning of the year. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you, Julie. Next on the agenda is the legislative update, which is questions only today. And our GR stars are all here and available for questions.
Well, there's a lot happening. It's a packed agenda down in Bolivia. And, I read all of it and I don't really have any questions.
I have no questions.
I have no questions either. Thank you for the report.
All right, then it is on to our update on the job description and market pay review project. And that will be three of our HR stars, Christy Schmidt, Drew Woolley, and Sarah Kurtz. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
My name is Christy Schmidt, and I'm a human resources consultant here at the PUD. And I'm here today on behalf of our job description project update team to provide an update on our project, as well as let you know about some upcoming next steps, which we'll be implemented on. So we acknowledge it's been a little while since we provided an update to you with regard to our project. So we want to make sure and let you know today what we've been working on with regard to, especially in 2022, we had a pretty heavy focus on some important work. We'll talk about at a high level some considerations around compensation philosophy and what our compensation philosophy might be at the PUD. And compensation philosophy is really that high level defines what will define our employee pay. So as a part of this, we'll look at some proposed market comparatives for pay today. We'll also touch on some pay equity project considerations as we start to move into looking at a completely new salary structure here at the PUD. And I think it's a good time for us to take a look, fresh look at our pay equity practices. We obviously are in compliance with the law currently today, but as a part of the project, we want to take a comprehensive look at that. And then we'll close with some discussions and next steps. So as you may recall, this project was actually initiated way back in October of 2019, and it's slated for completion this year and implementation in 2023. We came to commission a couple points during the project, once in September of 2020. We updated you on our project timeline. We gave a brief introduction to compensation philosophy, talked about setting compensation and salary structures at that time. And then we came again in April of 2021 to talk about project timeline, as well as an introduction to how we were going to go about updating our job descriptions, including competency-based and accountability-based job descriptions. So we're proud to say we are entering the final phase of our project. I'm happy to be here at this point, where we have finalized all of our job description content, and we're at the point of going out to look at market data to start to compare our job descriptions and finalize the implementation of this project. So we're going to really need your involvement in terms of the approval of our new salary structure that we'll be recommending and considering all the different impacts and locations that may have. That's not for today, that's for a future meeting, but just a heads up that is coming. Today we're really, our team's really seeking your input, questions and concerns with our proposed market comparators and the surveys that we're looking at. So I'll be covering that as we move through. So what have we been up to in terms of the project? So a big focus of our project, especially in 2022, was getting our job descriptions updated. As you may recall, it had been a while for our non-represented job descriptions to have a comprehensive look at and an update and a refresh. So we asked our managers to basically relook at their jobs, think about what they might want to include in their new job descriptions using that competency and accountability-based format. So as you can imagine, this was a pretty big lift for our managers, especially with given their day jobs. But it was important work, and it was work that we wanted to make sure we took the time to really get it right and have feedback back and forth from our managers and in collaboration with our ELT as well. So with that, we actually completed 300 job descriptions, brand new job descriptions, late last year. And we're happy to kind of be through that part of the process and moving into the second. So really today, we're looking to define who our market is for pay and benefits, and ensuring our approach with compensation really aligns with our strategic priorities. It's really important to us, especially with the priority of creating the culture and capabilities for the future is key to us in this project. So we want to make sure there's alignment there with what we decide. So I'll be previewing today, again, some of the market comparators and different surveys that we're looking at. Upcoming project milestones. So again, we'll be coming to you as a project team in the ELT, developing a proposed salary structure from our market analysis for your approval. And then our project team will provide you with an analysis of all the financial impacts and implementation options for your consideration. A lot of work on that.
So, Christina, and we updated these job descriptions. Did we reclassify the pay level for positions as we went?
Yeah, well, not as we went, but we will be. Now that we have the content dialed in, that's where we're going to be going out into the market and looking at what is the market paying for that position. So we'll be, that's to come, but as a part of this for sure. So what is a compensation philosophy? So really, we look at it as, again, kind of a formal statement that will document the district's position with regard to employee compensation. And it really explains the why behind and how we pay employees, and we wanted to create a good structure, a framework for consistency in the future. And part of it will define as well what our position will be relative to the market in pay. And thinking about total rewards for us, we're looking at considering both compensation and the value of our benefits. They combine to meet total rewards for us. Compensation, obviously, to us, we see that in our base pay, every paycheck we get, but as well as benefits have a value to employees as well. The PTO, monetary value, the 401k match that we have, the value they cover for our health benefits, all really big contributors to this. And it's pretty cool as an employee here at the PUD, I get to look at a statement that shows me all this information that just came out, so I can see the value of all my benefits, and I appreciate that. Something I appreciate having as an employee. And total rewards for us as well can include the non-financial rewards, such as just having good development opportunities here at the PUD. And we really tried to consider that as we were building out our job descriptions as well. As a part of compensation philosophy, we'll need to decide what our position relative to market will be. So some things that we're going to want to think about there is really who are our competitors for talent on the market. And who are we gaining our employees from, and who are we losing our employees to? These are some of the things that the team will be looking at. We did run some preliminary data back in 2020 where we looked at where our new hires were coming from. About 30% of our new hires were coming from public or other utilities, and about 70% were coming from private and non-utilities. So, and actually, I was part of that statistic. I was hired for the PUD in 2020, so I came from a large private employer myself. So we see that, that if we had to run the data today, I bet we would see similar trends in that.
Did you say about 30%?
30% from other utility, yeah, and other public, yeah. Private was about 70%. Yeah, so we're actually seeing a larger percentage in 2020 of employees coming from private. Yeah. So that's, again, data we'll want to pull and consider in our compensation philosophy. It's also important to us that we align our philosophy with our strategic priorities and direction, and that it's fiscally responsible as well. And we want to have a regular cadence, too, for just updating and looking at comp philosophy. It's not something we just kind of have one and done, but we want to have that be a part of our strategic planning as well. So more to come on compensation philosophy in terms of recommendations in our other meetings. And we do, again, want to just stress that the commission yourself retain the authority to approve any new salary schedule, which will be coming forward.
So when we talk about compensation philosophy, I certainly understand the philosophy that someone in a specific job will say job A may be very comparable to others. And job A and job B the same.
Yes.
But there's some jobs that are just undervalued, I guess I'll say, by society. So how do we, or do we do something, and we'll say that's job B, just it's undervalued, but we value that, those employees highly.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously there's an opportunity for them to leave us and go get job C somewhere or something else. How do we deal with that? inequity, I guess I'll say, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, that's a great question. For sure, we're going to be looking at, to me, we value all jobs, right? Every job here at the PUB is important to us, and we're going to look at the market and see what that job is paying. And I think if we have a good market position and paying that, we don't want to devalue any position below market, right? We want to make sure we're paying to the market at least and not behind. So in terms of, we hope that that strategy will help us in retaining the employee and also the great culture that we have.
Okay, I'm going to play off of that. Oh, excuse me.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, my point was the market undervalued, devalues.
The market undervalues?
Devalues some employees, right? So that.
You mean like teachers?
Could be teachers, yes. I was thinking food service workers.
Well, I guess we want to pay to the market, whatever that pay may be.
That's
so,
my answer.
We don't want to devalue any position here at the PUD for sure. So we'll pay as according to market.
And you may get to the SLM later, but I'm also interested in, and it may be later in your process, but looking at positions that may be hybrid here.
Hybrid in terms of,
and how are you going to, I don't need the details now, but I'm just interested that that is part of your research and involved in being embodied in your recommendations, because that happens here.
Yeah. Hybrid in terms of remote work, is that what you're talking about?
No. Hybrid in terms of the work that they are being asked to do.
Gotcha.
So being
going out in the market and looking at a title without really looking at, and then we may have the person under the same title.
Yes.
But their responsibilities may be significantly different.
Gotcha.
So I hope that that's going to be a consideration.
Yeah, I think I may be touching on this a little bit in the coming slides. But also, if I don't, let's circle back to it. Yeah, make sure we get that answered. Gotcha.
Wouldn't that be covered in the new job description, that it might be this in this in addition to this?
Yeah, so when we're going out and marketing a position, we're looking at the full job description content that was created. Mm-hmm. And we're going out and looking at salary surveys that as close of a match to that position as we can be, including maybe some of those things that don't tie directly to the title but are responsibilities. So we're looking at the content we have and looking at the content of the salary surveys to make matches there. So I think it will consider what you're speaking of, but you know, if there's any concerns a manager or anyone may have, we want to look at that.
Sure.
Fully market price for
that. Yeah, because that could tend to be, and maybe you just can't do it by check. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel, and I've done it, I will impose personal preference.
Sure.
Or I will interpret something. Mm-hmm. And so in HR working with folks, I just hope that that kind of thing is considered, and there probably is more guidance in assisting those that are developing job descriptions or hiring.
I hear
there's
you.
That personal that, well, I don't think that this is important, but maybe market would reflect that it is. And sometimes, as an individual, I may own that that's not important.
Gotcha.
So I don't know how you get us out of that hole.
I hear you. Yeah. No, and our project team has taken note of that, and we'll definitely consider that in terms of them moving on to
that. I think it's coaching here.
Yeah. We'll be covering any recommendations we have with our managers, so we'll be getting that two-way feedback.
You know, I think in a profession, you can know. You never know everything you might want to get involved in. I'm sure our general manager does a lot of things that maybe other general managers do or don't.
Sure.
And I know when I was teaching, for sure, you never know exactly everything that you might be expected. But that's what it means to be a professional.
Right. Yes. From the objective side of it, we try to find a position that's at least encompassing about 70% of what that job is doing.
Right, that's good.
Yeah, so it won't always be 100%, but as close as we can get.
Sure.
Yeah, you're right. There's always accountabilities and things that are other duties as assigned, right?
80% might be better.
Sure.
We're not going to get off this topic.
All right, I appreciate it. No, thank you. Thank you for that feedback. So moving into market comparators, so really our goal as a project team is we want to select surveys and data that represent the companies we're recruiting from and losing employees to. And again, we're really no longer finding that's limited to moving within other public utilities in Washington State. It's really much broader than that. So based on that, our project team is recommending we do consider a wide variety of comparators as we're looking at market pricing. So we still want to look at utility employers. We're a utility. We think that's important. But we want to consider non-utility employers as well. We want the local angle here to Snohomish County, to King County, local area, as well as regional, but national as well. In some cases, we have positions that we have to look nationally for, but the talent may not be here in Washington. So we want to look at that, and then both public and private employers as well in consideration. And where we can in the surveys, we'll have the ability to drill down into looking at organizations that are similar in size to us as a PUD, both in terms of customer size and revenue are two of the common cuts that we have there to look at. So we'll be considering that. Nothing's perfect in that data, but as close as we can, we want to get to organizations similar in size to us.
Well, I think it's very smart to be looking outside of just public utilities. Because people come and go, and they don't necessarily come.
Right, like I said, I came from private over public, yeah. So
it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, just looking for a job and a good company to land, so.
Yeah.
All right, so to go a little deeper here in our proposed surveys and market comparators. So we are looking at three key surveys to consider: Comp Analyst, Salary.com, Mellon, and Willis Towers Watson. These are all very large salary surveys in the compensation world, reputable. CompAnalystSalary.com represents both utility, non-utility employers, as well as national and local data. Mellon is really kind of our representation for local data and regional, and they have niche surveys such as technology, engineering, utilities. Can dive in there a little bit deeper. And Willis Towers Watson represents also utility, non-utility, as well as national and local data. They have surveys specialty in the energy sector, executive level, and general industry. And our project team thinks it's really important to consider salary surveys as our benchmark for market data. They represent a lot of different companies that participate in the surveys and can represent hundreds to thousands of incumbents behind that data. So it really helps us look at that big broad picture of seeing both the lows and the highs of market pay, as well as a lot in the average area. I think sometimes you might see a position, you know, listed on LinkedIn and see a pretty high dollar price and say that we need to pay this. But in the salary surveys, we hope that data is encompassed in there. And that's one data point versus many data points to look at in a survey format. So that's something we want to make sure we have that objective look.
Do we look at local job postings, like especially other government agencies, and sort of keep a handle on those come out?
Not regularly. Probably as we have new postings, I would imagine managers and are looking at that just to kind of have in their mind what the competition is locally. I think it's good to know, like, if another company is recruiting for the same role. But in terms of the compensation, that's again kind of like one data point, but we'll mark it to market based on our what we need to do. So touching on pay equity. So pay equity, we look at it as a project team as both a legal requirement that we need to comply with, obviously, but also a district value. And we really want to make sure we are equitable in our pay with employees and we are transparent in our practices, which we do today. RCW 49.58, the Equal Pay and Opportunities Act that took effect in 2018. This law promotes gender pay equity in Washington State through equal pay and all these other means. And this law really allows for specific permissible factors and pay differences that you might expect, like difference in years of education or experience or performance. Three common areas for pay differences there. So again, we're complying with the law as it is today, but as we start to look at these new salary structures we're going to create, that's where we just really want to take a fresh look again at it and really, what do we want to do in this regard? We have a great tool through salary.com that we're utilizing to do a lot of our data analysis. We will have all of our new job descriptions loaded in there. We'll be able to market price positions through the tool, and eventually when we come to mapping employees into the new job descriptions, we'll be able to have that data in there, which will really help us kind of understand and build out structures and see where people fall. So I guess all this to say, when we do come to you back with a recommendation for salary structure, we will have gone through all that rigorous pay equity data analysis. I just want to assure you of that. And all of this will be in collaboration both with our legal team and the EL team, as we've been keeping them apprised through this project.
A question, just a brief question. I thought I heard you say performance would be included.
Performance.
You would raise it a job in the hierarchy because someone performed well.
No.
That to me is.
No. I wasn't saying that. No, we would not want to do that, correct.
I wanted to clarify that.
Thank you. Thanks, Commissioner Hoslin. We were talking with regard to it's a reason we can pay somebody different. So if we're doing an analysis and we see someone has a higher level. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, fair question. Thank you. Yeah.
This is a little off from pay, but how do we ensure that we have equity and advancement for opportunities for employees? I mean, I know it's part of the DEI, but do we have some yardsticks we're thinking about as an HR organization to track that?
For sure, that's been top of mind. And again, I think as we crafted our job descriptions, we wanted to be able to provide pathways of progression and promotion here at the PUD. So both being able to come into a role and be able to progress through that role with time and competency for the role, as well as promotional opportunities. So I think today, probably maybe it's difficult sometimes for employees to move into a totally new career within the PUD, but I'm hoping our new structure where we've set up the gateways are pretty broad to get into something where that will help in that regard. We are thinking about that as a consideration for sure. I don't know that I have the complete answer to how, and it's a big, good question.
I just think there's such great value within having people stay in the organization.
It is.
And have new opportunities. I think you should bring things from one job to another.
Yes.
It's so powerful in an organization to
have
a better
understanding
of how it works.
Right, yeah, we want to see employees coming from one area over to another, bringing all that knowledge they have, right?
And I was just thinking, Commissioner, with the represented folks, that's very clearly stated in the contract with the non-unions.
Yeah.
I'm not proposing the same thing for the non-unions, but I was just thinking along the line that the union contracts helps when it's all negotiated.
Yes.
So it's a more of a linear.
Hi, Allison Jubb, HR Director. I just wanted to comment, and maybe we can then take it up in another meeting. But we do look every year at our promotion practices and look at them from an equity standpoint. So we look at gender and so forth and see that that's part of our affirmative action data that we actually look at statistically. So we look very detailed and looking at whether or not there are any patterns of promotions that are reflective of, maybe not as inclusive as we would want. So that is happening, and we do intend on coming back with just a high level overview of what our affirmative action day looks like for last year. So just wanted to table that a little bit, and then we'll come back with more information
on
that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you.
And I think their mentorship, Commissioner, their mentorship program kind of gets at what you're referring to.
We're excited about that implementation of that.
Sorry, we get you off track.
Oh, you're fine. Thank you. All right. So to close, I think I'm hearing good support from our proposed market comparators, but I want to pause here and just answer, kind of get the feel for if you feel like we're moving in the right direction in terms of our recommendation for market comparators.
Yeah. I'm interested in the outcome. I change my mind when I see the outcome.
We're
good at that.
We're looking forward to seeing the outcome as well. So for sure.
My only observation, I'm 125, 150, 200% on construction. I just hope as you go from step to step that if there's a need to go back and relook at something, that I have that flexibility.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We do, yeah. We don't want to rush through anything, in particular with this project, especially dealing would pay as very sensitive.
Employees' lives.
Yes, exactly, so.
Regarding market alignment, I imagine that you're also considering the culture that we're in and the times, the economic times that we're in.
Yes.
And I think there was millions of new jobs that were created nationally within the last month or so.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's a lot of hiring going on.
Yes.
And that's good for some and maybe not so good for others.
For sure, yeah. There's a lot of hiring going on. A lot of the big tech companies have been laying off, so we have a lot of talent on the market now looking for positions. So, you know, where we can, we hope to utilize that and take advantage of it.
I know a lot of engineers were laid off at Microsoft recently.
That's right, about 2000.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, I appreciate all the hard work that you're putting into this.
Thank you.
You, Allison, and the whole team.
Our whole team, yes. You are welcome, yep. And again, we'll move through in the next stages with bringing forward a proposed salary survey to you to review.
And we'll pile on to that because that is a good comment, Commissioner Wolf. That's, I think, even makes this exercise even more important, yep. Right? The market is not going to get easier to attract and retain. It's going to get more difficult. Unemployment is still extremely low, which is adversely affecting inflation. Mm-hmm. So this is a very, very important exercise and process for us. We want to get it right.
Thank you.
You should never ask us to ask questions, but and this one will come later. But in within the definition of a market, does that include consideration of cost of living?
Yeah, cost of labor probably. We are considering here in Washington State. Obviously, we have
cost
a little bit.
Of labor and cost
of labor is like how much it costs us to pay an employee to the market level.
I was thinking of the cost of the employee
living, cost of living
to take a job here and the cost of living.
Yes, we are considering that as part of our project and how we're looking at the surveys. Yep, absolutely. Yep. You understand it's a higher cost of labor and living here. So.
We have so many factors. We have a matrix.
We have a lot of good people helping us out.
No, it's squares on a dartboard. I was just thinking it's a big round circle with all kinds of little circles inside of it.
For sure.
Sorry.
No problem.
Yeah, along the same topic, do people leave us for other local jobs? Do we have an exit survey, a conference with them, and so we understand when we're losing people because of pay?
We do, yeah. We do have an exit process, so where we engage with employees. Now, whether they want to let us know that information, that's another thing, but we we do want to understand that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I will look forward to your recommendations as they come forth. I don't think we answer your question. Should it be at market 50 of the head of Mark Light? Those questions are really with your guidance.
Right. Yeah. And at this point, we're not asking for a recommendation today for that, but really just are we moving in the right direction with
exactly.
Who we're looking at? Yeah.
Right.
So it sounds like that's a positive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And we look forward to talking with you again. All right.
Good work.
Thanks.
Excellent job, Christy. Next up is Maureen Barnes with an update on our City of Everett Interurban Recreational Trail easement extension. Good morning, Maureen.
Good morning, thank you. I'm Maureen Barnes, Manager of Real Estate Services. There we go. Okay. The purpose of the presentation today is to inform the board of our request to extend the current agreement with the City of Everett for an additional year as we continue to negotiate with them to get a new 25-year trail easement in place. We're requesting approval to move forward, and then that way at the meeting of February 21st, vote to go ahead and do that extension. The Northwest Traction Company, also PNT, in the early 20th century electric rail systems called interurbans flourished. The one that went from Seattle to Everett was in operation for 29 years and it spanned 29 miles. In the 30s, Puget Power and Light purchased that, and then they converted it to a power line corridor. In 1949, Snohomish Public Utility District purchased that electrical distribution system from them. And then in the 90s, Snohomish County with Everett to Linwood built a 12-mile pedestrian and bicycle trail called the Inner Urban. In 2018, a new 25-year recreation trail easement was negotiated with the city of Linwood, and this has been serving as our template as we move forward on getting these new agreements in place.
May I ask you right there?
Yes.
I saw that there were some people in Edmonds who were asking us to work with them on extending the interurban so that it would provide more safety for bicycles where it joins with Shoreline.
Exactly. And actually, we have been in contact with them. And right now it's more on the Shoreline side, not so much on our side, but we've let them know that we'll support them in any way.
That's great.
So the recreation trail easement with the city of Everett is close to expiring. And right now we have a permanent easement in place with the city of Edmonds. City of Mount Lake Terrace has expired. City of Linwood has an agreement in place. Snohomish County is very, very close to having that agreement in place. So what we're asking for is a one-year extension so that we can continue negotiating with the city of Everett to make sure that both of our concerns are met. Let's see. I think I pretty much went over all of this. I will say that the city of Everett is on board with the extension, and the mayor is willing to sign as long as it's approved by the commission. That's about it for me. Any questions?
Yeah, so this would be the third extension. Is,
yes.
Is there a challenge that we're having between the two parties, or is this low-hanging fruit? We have lots of other things that are more important to work on. We need an arbitrator, but
no,
how can you characterize the negotiations?
The negotiations are moving forward very, very well right now with Snohomish County, and we have a real strong feeling that the city of Mount Lake Terrace and the city of Everett will kind of follow their lead. And I will be perfectly blunt, the main sticking point has been more of a split on dealing with encampments and illegal uses along the trail.
Mm-hmm. Those cities are the ones ultimately responsible for maintenance of those sections, right?
Exactly, yes, yes. But because in many places it's 60, 75, even 100 feet across, not just the actual trail area,
right,
because people are coming in via the trail,
yeah,
and then setting up an encampment or other nefarious things.
Of which there are many.
Unfortunately, yes.
Thank you.
Look at this map, and it's almost the path of the light rail.
I kind of have a feeling they might have looked at that too.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen.
Thanks.
And last on the agenda for this morning is our Washington Open Government Hearing with Sarah DiViterio, and I believe Sarah is going to be virtual. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great, I apologize for not being present in person. I am currently struggling with bronchitis and I didn't wanna come and hack in person. So I'll hack virtually for you. So we'll begin with the open government training. I'm not sure how to advance, Jenny.
Sarah, just go ahead and click on the screen and you should be able to advance. There you go.
Oh, hey, look at that. Okay. Sorry, I got a little lap happy there. Can I go back?
Yep, absolutely.
Got it. There we go. Okay. So we're going to go over three different areas of the law: the records retention law, which is chapter 4014 RCW, the Public Records Act, which is Chapter 4256 RCW, and the Open Public Meetings Act, which is Chapter 4230 RCW. You're required to complete this training as elected officials. It's for informational purposes only, and no follow-up action or next steps are needed on your part. We'll begin with records retention. So the basic overarching theme is what is a public record and what do you need to be concerned about? The records retention law defines a public record as any writing containing information relating to the conduct of government or the performance of any governmental or proprietary function prepared, owned, used, or retained by any state or local agency, regardless of physical form or characteristics. It is a very broad definition. It applies to all forms of communication, whether it be emails, text messages, sticky notes, phone logs, file folders that are in a folder drawer somewhere, a disk, any of the items that you see in the lovely depictions that are contained on the slide. And then the other piece that's important to note is that prepared, owned, used, or retained language, meaning that even if it's something that we don't own, if it's something that we use as a governmental agency, it can still be considered our public record. And we'll talk more about that as we talk through the Public Records Act. So with records retention, we have two questions that you have to ask yourself about any public record. The first question is, do I have to retain it? The I is emphasized for a reason. Every public record has different retention depending on whose public record it is. So if it's a record that you are obligated to retain, then you need to keep it. If it's not a record that you need to obligated to retain, then you need to ask yourself the second question, which is, do I want to retain it? And if you want to retain it, that's great. But if you do, you need to consider the consequences of retention. And if not, then you need to delete that record. So for example, you were given a presentation packet in preparation for today's commission meeting. The only person in the district who is required to keep a copy of that presentation packet is Melissa Collins. As the clerk of the board, the clerk of the commission, it's her responsibility to retain the commission materials. And they have a retention associated with them. Not sure what it is off the top of my head, but it has a specific retention associated with it. So she's the I. She has to keep it. So you all could choose to keep it as commission members, to keep a copy for yourself with whatever notes you've written on it, and that's perfectly acceptable. The consequence of that decision, however, is that if we get a public records request for all copies of the commission packet from today, you'll have to provide your copy to me, the public records officer, to turn over in response to a public records request. If you don't decide you don't need it, you don't have to keep it because you're not one of the individuals that's obligated to retain it. So some basics with records retention. There are two types of public records. There's records that deal with the conduct of business that have some retention associated with them. So that varies in all types from post-it notes all the way to district policies and procedures that are formally adopted. The other type of public records are transitory records that have a very limited, minimal value and can be destroyed as soon as you don't need them anymore. And we're going to talk in some depth about those transitory records because those are the ones that you really need to just focus on not keeping because they clog up our system. If we as a district got rid of all of the transitory records that we didn't need to have, we would reduce the number of records that we have substantially because that makes up the bulk of records. So if you are obligated to maintain a document, you have to keep it in its native format, which means that it has to be kept in the format that it was created in. So let's talk through some examples of that. The native format of an email is an email. So if you sit down at your computer and you type an email to Melissa, you have to keep that email as an email. It's not acceptable to print it out, keep a hard copy in a file somewhere, and delete the electronic version of that record. You have to keep the email version because it was created as an email. A Word document is created in Microsoft Word, but a Word document's kind of funky because usually when we're creating something in Word, we're not completing it until it's printed and signed. Usually something in Word is a letter, or it's a memorandum, or it's a contract, or it's something that has a final written signature on it that makes it a complete document. In that case, the document doesn't become a final completed document until it's signed. So it's the actual paper version that is the final completed document and the way that the record needs to be kept. When we're talking about PDFs, it is possible to do that whole scan and toss technique, which I'm sure that you've probably heard of, where we scan our records in and keep them electronically instead of keeping the paper form. That's okay. The governor's office, the secretary of state has told us that we can do that. We just have to follow specific requirements to do that for how we scan. And so that's something that the DIG office takes very seriously and makes sure that we comply with those requirements when we are converting our documents.
Commissioner Olson, excuse me.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Commissioner Olson, I don't see anything in here, and maybe it's later on. What about text, content of text, or
so
Zoom, or I mean, I don't know if those things are a record or what.
They are considered a record, yes. Text messages are very difficult because if you ask a room full of IT professionals what the native format of a text message is, you'll get either no answer or 50 different answers. Trust me, I've tried. So what I encourage you to do is if you are using text messages to communicate district business, it needs to be only transitory communications, things like I'm running 5 minutes late for the meeting, or I'm ill, so I'm not going to be there today, or please remind me that I need to leave 10 minutes early. Something simple, transitory that doesn't need to be kept, and delete that text message right away because we don't need to keep it. If you're going to do something substantive, business related in a text message, you shouldn't do it in text. But if you do send it as a text, you should forward that text to an email account so it's retained as an email. And then Zooms, if we are recording, which we clearly are right now, those are maintained as a Zoom recording.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Question about Word documents. I guess this could apply to emails as well. So, you know, often when I compose a document, I'll compose it, I'll print it out, easier to find mistakes, errors, I'll do some editing. So I guess I need to destroy all those prior versions, right? Because there's the final version of a Word document, but there, in my experience, there could be 5 or 10, you know, versions before that.
You sound like me. I am a paper editor. I can't edit on the computer. I have to print it out and use my red pen. That's how my brain works. So yes, you are exactly right. When you print it out and you sit there with your pen and you edit and you change things, I like to walk down to another attorney's office and give them a copy on paper and have them write on it, or I send it via email and say, hey, mark this up and send it back to me. All of those drafts, all of those versions do not need to be maintained once the final version has been created. You are correct.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. But please be advised that if those versions are kept, they are public records that are subject to disclosure. So a lot of times I will get asked, well, it's just a draft. I shouldn't have to send out the draft because we made a final and we made a change in the policy decision, or we made a change based on legal advice. And so that draft is no longer valid. That doesn't matter. If it exists at the time we get a public records request for it, we still have to turn it over if we still have it. So it's a good practice to get rid of those drafts once you no longer need them. All right, so two basic rules for retention. What we've talked about, the format of the record determines how you retain it. So for example, if it's an email, you keep it as an email. The second rule is that the content determines how long or if you retain it. So for example, if it's transitory, it can be destroyed as soon as you don't need it anymore. So when you write down on a piece of paper the voicemail, it was Sean Arano calling, here's her phone number, and you return that phone call, you can just throw that piece of paper away because the content was transitory. It doesn't need to be kept. If it's something that has a retention associated with it, For example, an officially adopted policy or directive, one copy has to be kept by the district permanently. So there's one copy of that directive and one copy of that policy that is maintained by the district forever. We keep it for a specific period of time, and then it's transferred to the Washington State Archives for permanent retention. So it depends on what the actual record is. So oftentimes I get asked, well, can I just go back and delete all of my emails that are older than 2 years? If I haven't used them in 2 years, I don't need them. So I might as well just get rid of them, right? You can't do that. It depends on the content of every single email, whether or not it needs to be retained. So some emails you can make a blanket determination that they don't need to be retained. So I'm sorry, Julie, if you're still in the room, I'm going to say this out loud. The district daily emails, you can delete them all. You don't need to retain any of them because it's not your responsibility. You didn't create that record. Julie's office has to keep one copy of that record for a defined period of time, but nobody else does within the district. Okay.
So when it comes to commissioners, you know, what emails would we be required to keep? I'm trying to think of an email that we would be required to keep. And if there was a valuable email, it seems like it would also be the clerk would have been copied on it. So does the original sender have to keep the email?
So I in theory, there's not much that you should be keeping. Okay. And I say in theory because it depends on what your practices are. But if you were to receive a communication from the public that nobody else was CC'd on, that's something that you would need to keep. However, if it's your practice, if you received a communication from the public to immediately forward it on to Melissa, and you've designated Melissa as the keeper of those types of communications, then you would not need to keep the copy. Melissa would be responsible for keeping that copy. So it depends on what the practices of the commission and the commission office are as to what needs to be maintained. In theory, if you're not receiving things as an individual and Melissa or somebody in the commission office is copied on all of those communications and the commission office has taken on the responsibility of retaining what needs to be retained, then you're right. You do not need to be keeping much. I can't think of anything even off the top of my head if that responsibility has been assigned to the commission office.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to go back to that for a second. Where we run into trouble, where I've seen the most trouble when it comes to commissions, boards, elected officials in general, is when there's communication going on with the public on private email accounts that involve the business of the elected official. That's where I've seen the most problem in the past. Prior to my work here at the district, I worked at Snohomish County for quite a while. And that's where our biggest payouts came from at the county, was when we had elected commissioners or elected council members who were using their personal email accounts because they had been using them before they were elected. And constituents just had a habit of communicating with them there. And they didn't get in the habit of forwarding those communications into the county. So they were sitting in personal email accounts. That's where we run into trouble. So as long as you are not using your personal email accounts for any type of district business, or if you are in a regular established habit that you do not deviate from, where you forward all communication that you do receive in a personal account immediately to your commissioner email account, I can't see that we're going to have a whole lot of trouble with you when it comes to the public records world. Okay. So transitory records, I'm going to fly through these next few slides fairly quickly because you have them in front of you and you can refer back to them as you need to, but you have them if you need them. So these can be records created or received by the district. They're typically of short-term temporary information or use. They can be deleted or destroyed as soon as you don't need them anymore. When I say when in doubt, retain it, I mean that only for the three of you. And this is contrary to what I tell every other district employee, but I'm saying it to you because you three are the face of the district. And I don't want you to ever be in a position where you go, I didn't know if I should keep it or not, so I just deleted it. Okay, if you ever have a question of whether or not, if you're confident you can delete it, delete it. If you have a question in your head of whether or not you should delete it, ask Melissa, who will come to me, and I will tell her what you should be doing with the record, or just keep it, okay? I want you to err on the side of caution, because I don't want you as an individual to ever be in a position where you say, I didn't know, so I deleted it, okay?
Okay. So it's okay that I have thousands of emails.
It's okay. I don't like it, but it's okay.
I don't like it either.
I get that. But as a public official, aren't we required to retain everything?
No, you are not.
Responsibility to the public. Okay. I get more lawyers in here shaking your head, so I'll drop the question.
You are not required to retain everything. You're required to comply with the retention requirements established by the Secretary of State's office. But they are very nuanced, and I'm happy to walk you through on an individual level if you would like me to. I'm happy to sit down with you at your computer and give you a one-on-one tutorial about what you can and cannot delete if you'd like. That's why I get paid the big bucks, right?
This is we're talking about deleting off records that retain. Yeah. Whether they be email, et cetera, et cetera. Are we going to get later to handwritten notes during the public meeting?
Well, and we're going to talk more about notes in open public meetings as we go through.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I'm done.
Okay.
We're required to produce everything. We're just not required to retain.
Right.
Sarah, this is Commissioner Wolf. I have a question.
Yes.
So what about file folders? I haven't figured out how to create file folders yet. After 4 years, but if I could, I would like to have some file folders for certain kinds of things that I get from the district or related to the district. How do you treat those?
Are you talking about electronic or paper?
Documents that are filed into computer or file folders.
So I guess I need more information from you. Inside your Outlook file for the commission, or are you talking about just
inside of my Snohomish PUD address?
Okay, so everything that's within your Snohomish PUD account is a Snohomish PUD record. So
if it goes, I mean, I don't have any yet, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. I only have junk, trash, deleted, things like that.
Right.
You know, but it would be nice to have some file folders, right? Mm-hmm. And articles and things that, so, I mean,
we can
so
help.
I guess I repeat the question, how do you regard those?
Mm-hmm. Well, the nice part about using that file structure like that within your Outlook system is that it's fully searchable by IT. So that means that if we got a request for anything related to you, I would just have IT pull the information for me.
Okay.
So feel free to create that file structure if you need assistance with creating that. I'm sure Melissa could help you with that.
Just gave me a signal that she could and would. So
I saw that. I saw the signal, even from my little teeny tiny screen.
I should have asked several years ago, but anyway.
But that's great to have that kind of structure within your Outlook, because it's fully accessible to IT and thus accessible to me, which makes it easy on the public record side.
Well, good to know. Thank you.
Yes. Excuse me. Okay, so as I said, we're just going to go through these pretty quickly. So these are examples of transitory records. So copies of agency generated forms and publications like the District Daily, brainstorming and collaborating records. So you're in a meeting and you're using the whiteboard to brainstorm. Contact information that you may contain in Outlook, business cards that you've got sitting on your desk, drafting and editing. Those are the things that you were talking about. Electronic documents used to create signed paper records, which we talked about. Internet browsing on individual computers, that doesn't need to be kept. To-do list, tasks, routing slips, notes. So the individual notes that you may maintain within a commission meeting that you're sitting down and writing for your own personal edification, Those do not need to be maintained long term. However, if you do maintain them, they are subject to public disclosure.
Well, so any note, anything I've ever, have I misinterpreted this for 30 years?
Say it again, I'm sorry.
I thought that anything that we wrote either in public session or executive session as an elected official, that, that those handwritten notes or whatever you use have to be maintained.
They have to be produced if we have
a, if we have a request.
A request is coming. That's, yeah. Yeah. We have had those requests.
Yes.
Yes, but they don't have.
You have to retain them. If you, how can you produce them if you don't retain them?
Right, but you don't. You just because they have to be produced doesn't mean they have to be retained.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Does that simplify your life now?
Well, it does. I mean, I've always been. I write in shorthand so that. Because I thought that I had to turn everything in.
Well, you do if you keep it.
You would have to if there's a records request.
Yes.
But if I'm being told that I don't have to retain it, then it doesn't exist.
Only if you've destroyed it. So if you take notes and you take it home and you file it away. Sorry, Sarah.
No, that's fine.
You take notes today and you go home and file it away and we get a records request for those notes that you wrote during today's meeting, you would then have to provide those to the district for the records request. If you take that piece of paper and you go shred it and we get a records request, there is no record to produce. Does that make sense?
Well, alternatively,
if you're saying it, it's not what I've understood for years. But that's
right.
Cool. You don't have to say all this stuff.
So it does
simplify
your life.
Alternatively,
I just get a little worried though.
Okay.
Well, and if I may, if you do take notes of everything that occurs at the meeting today and you go home tonight over the next couple of days and you pick out the two or three things that you believe that you would like to keep, that's great. Put them on a different piece of paper and then shred the rest. Keep the two or three things of import that you would like to have 6 months from now, and you can shred the rest. You don't need to maintain every single thing you wrote down. It's up to your discretion. Those are considered your personal notes. But like Melissa said, if you do have them and we receive a request for them, the expectation is you must turn them all over.
Got it.
Okay. So records document is part of more formalized records. So working rough notes, voicemail messages, text messages, social media posts, etc. We're going to talk more about those as we go through. Reference materials. I say don't forget RSS feeds. So there's a feature within your email card on RSS feed. If you see in your Outlook, it says RSS feeds. If there's a number next to where it says RSS feeds, call Melissa and we're going to fix that for you. If there's not, don't worry about it. And then requests for basic routine information, like when is the next meeting, that kind of stuff.
Excuse me, Ms.
Yeah.
What is an RSS feed?
An RSS feed is an opt-in to a news service within the Outlook system. And so it can inadvertently get turned on and you will be getting daily news bulletins. I had someone who accidentally turned it on one time and they had over 25,000 accidental news feeds sitting in their email account that we had to deal with in a public records request. So I don't like them.
Oh, good to know though.
Uh-huh. So general information, junk mail, the things that you would consider junk mail that you get electronically, informational notifications, those out of office emails that you get, those are considered in there. Scheduling appointments and meetings. You do not need to keep all of the emails that go back and forth to schedule meetings. You do, however, as elected officials, need to keep your appointment that actually show up on your calendars. So your calendars need to be kept. Secondary copies. So that's what I referenced at the beginning. Like when you got a packet, a copy of the commission packet, that's a secondary copy. It does need to be kept. unsolicited additional materials, things that people send you that you didn't ask for, and personal emails that don't discuss district business. Simply put, you should not be sending emails around on the district email address that deal with personal business. Prevention is the first step.
Go back to that last bullet.
Yeah.
Personal emails. Oh, I got it. Personal stuff on district business. Move on.
Yeah. Yeah, just don't do it. It's just a good general rule.
Oh, yeah.
So that's where I get to the prevention. Do you really need to create a public record? So before you send an email, ask that question of yourself. Do I really need to create a public record? Can I pick up the phone and call Melissa instead of sending her an email? Is that the best? Is that the better choice? Just ask yourself that question. Be mindful of what you put into the public record. And then draw a line between your personal life and your commission life and don't cross it. I mean, we all have known each other. Well, most of us have known each other for quite some time. And so we know our spouses and our kids and our dogs and our cats, and we want to engage in that polite social banter. Just try and refrain from it as much as possible in the written record. If you do discuss it, just expect that it will go out in response to a public records request.
So, Sarah,
yes.
If I wanted to send a photo of my new grandson to Allison, where would that, what category would that fall? Would that be a record, public record, with a picture of my little lady grandson?
Yes. And there's lots of public records of my grandkids all over the district.
I'm glad you said that, John. I was going to use you as my example, John.
Yes, there you go. Walk right into it.
We have a New Year's little boy, and it's pretty beautiful, so anyway.
Yeah, just be thoughtful of that. I mean, I'm knocking on synthetic wood product over here. We don't get a lot of requests for the contents of people's email accounts. It's a rarity around here. In my previous lives, it's not been a rarity, so I've been very strict about telling people never, ever to do that. It's a possible consequence that I will have to release it to some random member of the public.
But if I send it on my personal phone, from my personal phone,
John's personal phone, then it's not a public record. But if you send it from your personal phone to John's PUD account, it is a public record.
Thanks. Okay.
All right.
You know, on the subject of email, and Melissa, please help me. I understand this. My understanding is that when we delete files on our iPhone and iPad, they're not actually deleted. The only way to delete them is to use our laptops and to go into our Outlook account. Is that your understanding?
I believe so. Sean, do you know anything about that?
Sarah can weigh in on this as well. From a technical standpoint, there is usually a time frame associated with your trash can on your phone and also on any other electronic device and the computer. So those files will be emptied if you put these into the trash. But if you want to be sure, you delete and empty the trash.
So
it's a double delete.
Yeah. I can give you so two things on that. There's a setting on your iPad and your iPhone to sync it with the Outlook on your desktop so that when you delete on your iPad and your iPhone, it deletes it from the desktop as well. So you want to make sure that's turned on.
Yeah, okay.
And then the other piece of that is Sean is correct. When you delete it from your deleted item from your inbox, the backup of the server occurs once a day. And if there's somebody from IT in the room and you're cringing as I speak, I'm sorry. Once the backup occurs, that is backed up in the system, which means even if you delete it, it'll sit in our backup for 30 days. If you delete it from the system before the backup occurs, so you delete and then you double delete, it will actually be deleted from the server.
How do you double delete?
It's a process that I'm happy to show you, but it's too hard to explain via my voice to you over this system. So,
I don't really worry about it. I just
It's not
the FBI coming after me or anything.
Yeah. And it's something I'm happy to show Melissa how to do if she has any questions, and she could probably walk you through it if you'd like to learn how to do it.
We'll walk you through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bring it up because I don't delete a lot of files, as I was joking about earlier, but I realized after like 3 or 4 years, I think it was the pandemic, when I had a laptop. We never had laptops until that all those files that I had been deleting on my iPad weren't really, they were deleted from my iPad, but they weren't really deleted on stuff.
Yeah.
Just an FYI.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely have to have them synced.
I made a note of that. Get a request, it'll be on the note.
Okay. So I'm going to talk quickly about personal mobile devices. I'm going to ask you to raise your hand because I can see you. Do you all use a district-owned mobile device, or do you use a personal mobile device? So if you use a district one, please raise your hand.
What if you use both for different purposes?
Do you use your personal mobile device for district business?
No.
Is that a no from all three of you?
Oh, how do I?
Yes, that's a no.
No from all three of you. Okay. All right, so if you did use your personal mobile device, you're subjecting it to a search if we receive a public records request, and it would require an affidavit. Huh?
Or a lawsuit.
Or a lawsuit, yeah. It's just not a good choice, so don't do it. Use your district-owned device for all district business is the best course of action. Okay, social media. All of district social media sites are archived. Your personal social media site should not be used for district business. Do not comment on social media in an official capacity. And you three should be extra cautious to keep separate district, personal, and candidate social media. And there, if you have any questions about that, there is a case out of Pierce County that I would be happy to share with you that talked in detail about delineating between the three types of platforms in the social media world.
I just don't do any of them.
That too. Okay, so personal, nothing is personal. If it's on a district device, it belongs to the district. Nothing is personal about district business. If it's about the district, it belongs to the district. And if the district gets a request for the contents of your computer, smartphone, or iPad, it will be turned over. Minimal redactions can be taken. So those are just the basics. So now we're going to switch into the Public Records Act. Some basics. It was passed in 1972. It received 72% of the popular vote. It's the most popular initiative in Washington state history. It was combined with campaign reform and the Open Public Meetings Act at the time. So that's part of the explanation for why it was the most popular initiative ever. It's since been pulled out into its own portion of the statute. The purpose of the PRA is that they are the people's records. They have the right to know how the government functions, and it is not our right to keep that information from them. So again, what is a public record? It's that same definition, a writing containing information relating to the conduct of government or the performance of a governmental function prepared, owned, used, or retained by a governmental agency. Our responsibilities as employees and commissioners for the district, we're obligated to produce all public records unless a specific exemption applies. And even if an exemption applies, we're obligated to gather the public records and retain them in a separate file. So where I see this come into play most often is attorney-client privileged information. A lot of times people will say, oh, well, it's attorney-client privilege because the attorney wrote on this, so I don't have to give it to you because you're not going to turn it over anyway. I still need to get a copy of it as the district's public records officer because I have to review it, mark it, and exempt it from production, and I have to maintain a copy of it for 2 years after I claim the exemption. So even if it's exempt, it still has to be gathered and produced to me, and I will assert the exemption on the district's behalf. We have to provide the fullest assistance to the requester and apply exemptions sparingly. We have to go above and beyond in helping out the requester and trying to figure out what they want and how to get it to them. Requests for public records have to be for identifiable records. There has to be fair notice that people are seeking public records. So usually that means somebody has to say, under the Public Records Act, I'm requesting the following. We as a district interpret it more broadly, where if someone asks us for records in general, we assert it. We assume that it's a public records request and it gets routed through me. There are times where I say, let's not treat this as a public records request. Let's route it a different way. That's kind of up to my discretion as the attorney for the district on these particular issues. A request for information is not a request for records. At a minimum, the requester has to identify what documents they want with sufficient clarity to allow for us to find them. And we aren't required to be mind readers, but we are required to provide the fullest assistance. So if we're able to kind of glean what they're looking for, we have to work with them to figure it out. Requesters can inspect or get copies. Usually people want copies. And then we can adopt procedures about how we want requests processed, which we have. We have a directive that covers it. Requesters don't have to tell us who they are. They don't have to tell us why they want the records. They don't have to limit the number of requests that they make. And they don't have to tell us they don't like our response before they file a lawsuit against us. The Act itself is written very pro-requester, which makes sense because these are considered the people's records, not ours. So it's written in favor of disclosure. Our responsibilities as employees and commissioners, our first responsibility is to gather all records that are potentially responsive to a request. So if we receive a request for all of Sean Arano's records regarding the Jackson project, the first thing I would do is I would go to Sean, let her know that the request had been received, ask her to pull any hard files that she might have. Then I would go to IT and have IT search all of her directories and all of her email and pull everything with the word Jackson in it. I would then look around for other leads related to other terms she might have used other than Jackson in her communications to try and identify all the records. Then I would go down to Generation and see who else might have records related to Sean that Sean sent to them. So it could get bigger and bigger and bigger. Once we get all of the records gathered, we're required to review them, which means that I then sit down and review all of those potentially responsive records to determine if they are actually responsive and then determine if anything gets redacted or withheld. We then produce all of the records. So we give them to the requester in the format which the requester asks for. Usually that's electronically. And then finally, I, as the district's public records officer, am obligated to complete to keep a complete file of all the records produced, both in their original format and the format that we produced them with all the exemptions and the withholdings for a 2-year period.
And you only have 5 days to do all of that?
It's a 5 days for the initial response. So the initial response can be, here's all your records, or it's going to take me X amount of days to get this processed, or we don't have anything, or look at our website, or help, I don't understand what you're asking for, give me more information. So
getting around to it.
Yeah. So usually the bulk of our requests are answered within 5 days. Because the bulk of our requests are looking primarily for mapping data, and we're pretty efficient at gathering that stuff. So here's that slide on the 5 days. But we do have to respond within that 5 business days. If we don't respond within that 5 business days, we have violated the law, period. And the penalties for violation of the Public Records Act, we'll talk about in just a minute. So your individual responsibilities in responding to a public records request, you're responsible for understanding how to manage your electronic records, which we talked about. You're responsible for understanding how to manage your paper records. And you're responsible for keeping your records in their native format, so not printing out emails and deleting the electronic version. And then you're responsible for providing your records to Melissa when she asks for them. And Melissa is my contact person. I'm not going to come straight to you and ask for records. I'm going to go through Melissa. So when she asks you for the records, it's me asking too. So if you were to receive a request from a citizen, so let's say somebody walked up to you after a commission meeting and said, here's my public records request, and handed it to you. What should you do? You need to get it to Melissa or to me right away. Like I said, we only have 5 days to respond, so you don't want to delay in forwarding it. Penalties under the Public Records Act are quite substantial, so we need to act quickly. If Melissa tells you to look for records, you're responsible for looking thoroughly and promptly. The standard under the law is to look in all locations where you would reasonably expect to find responsive records. So that means if it's asking for emails, you look where you would have emails. If it's asking for hard files, you look where you would have hard files. So you need to figure out where it's reasonably expected to find responsive records. And always keep in mind that an electric search may not be sufficient. If you did have that habit of printing out emails because you hadn't heard this presentation before, then you would be responsible for looking for in paper files for emails. Enforcement and penalties, it's enforced by the courts. There's civil penalties, there's no damage required. The penalty is up to $100 per day, per page for records withheld. So if it's a 10-page document, it's up to $1,000 a day. And, you know, you can go from there. It can be quite high. There are factors that mitigate and aggravate the penalty, depending on the particular facts of the case. And then the agency is always required to pay attorney's fees and costs, which is really where the rubber meets the road. When I was at the county, one of our biggest penalties was about $320,000, but we ended up paying $450,000 in attorney fees on top of it. So why should you care? It's everybody's responsibility. Our insurance fund does not pay for public records violations. It is not covered by insurance. It comes out of the operating budget. I can't do everything, so I need your help. I don't know where all the records are. I don't know what all the records are. So I need the help of everybody in the district to figure out what we've got and where it is so that I can get it to the requester when it's asked for. And, oh, it got deleted on there. The final thing of why you should care is because you're a representative of the government, right? You know, you are the face of the district. And so if we have a public records violation, it reflects poorly on all of us when one of us doesn't do our job. So are there any questions on the Public Records Act before I slide into the OPMA?
I have a quick one. I'm curious if, you know, their dig initiative, if public records requests are getting easier for you to accomplish.
Our volume has gone down. I would say that they are not getting particularly easier or harder. We have, like I said, the bulk of our requests tend to be usage records that are handled by customer service. And then map records that are handled by GIS. But then we get some other random requests here and there. Some can be very complicated and some can be easier, but the volume has definitely gone down in my tenure here, and I've been here, it'll be 4 years in March, and our volume has gone down.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Olson, sorry, I'm going to continue talking on this. Commissioner retaining records or notes, what if a commissioner pre-meeting was preparing some comments or thoughts in terms of perhaps budget deliberation or commissioner and staff deliberation on some topic? The commissioner has either typewritten or stored electronically or whatever, has that outline and created that outline. Is that a public record?
Yeah, as long as it exists. It is a public record, yes.
Okay, thanks. Maybe that's where I was confusing the notes.
Okay, it is a public record. It, is your question, is it a public record that needs to be retained?
Well, yeah. You talk about it in a public meeting. It's something that you created to talk about or raise questions or whatever, but you created that for the purpose of using it during a public meeting. Does that need to be retained?
If it's the notes that you've created for yourself for purposes of presenting a topic during the public meeting, the answer is no. If it's something that you create that you make as a part of the public meeting, i.e. it's provided and incorporated as a part of the minutes or as an attachment to the minutes, then yes.
Well, what is permanent is what's on the recording that you actually said from your notes.
Correct.
I think I get that.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think the challenge for us is we don't need to, we need to retain almost nothing, but we have to produce everything if a request is made. I think that's the challenge.
But if it's on a recording and you used your notes and then you threw your notes away, then
right.
It's on the recording.
Right.
Sorry.
And that will beg the question, and it's certainly the optics of the situation is something to consider, right? If you're standing there, if you're sitting there and you're holding up a piece of paper and you're reading from it, and then the public records request comes in that says, I want that piece of paper, and you say, I don't have it anymore because I destroyed it, there's certainly an optics question related to that. But the response to that is, under the Secretary of State's records retention requirements, you're not obligated to retain that piece of paper. So it was not kept. It was destroyed in accordance with the guidelines from the Secretary of State's office.
Okay, so you can direct them to the recording.
Mm-hmm, correct. And the recording has to be maintained.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to transition into the OPMA. And I would say the OPMA gets more press than any other law related to boards and commissions in the state of Washington. There was actually an article just a couple of days ago about the school board in Monroe and a potential violation of the OPMA. So all meetings of the governing body of a public agency shall be public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body of the public agency, except as otherwise provided. The otherwise provided is executive session, which we'll talk about. So the basic requirements, all meetings are required to be open and public. Public comment must be allowed prior to or at all regular meetings. That's a relatively new change to the law. Quorum, generally a meeting occurs when a majority of the body is in attendance and action is taken. All persons permitted to attend meetings with no preconditions. No voting by secret ballot. Public notice requirements are for general and special meetings.
So, Sarah, can I stop you right there? Before
you can.
Or may I? So if it's a retreat, which is considered a meeting, then anybody can come in, they can comment, all of that is permitted.
Yes. You have to give the ability for public comment prior to or at the meeting. So if you're doing it prior to, but that's a regular meeting, not a special meeting. I would consider a retreat a special meeting.
Yeah. Special meeting.
So the change in the...
But not an executive session.
Okay. Oh, no, I wasn't.
Okay,
to
that's
executive.
Okay.
So
yeah, a retreat would be a special meeting. The public comment requirement is for regular meetings.
So is the public comment requirement for any comment, or is it only for comment on the business that's happening at that meeting?
That I don't know. I would have to look more specifically. I can follow up on that for you, though.
Yeah, I had always understood it was for that and not just for any comment. We do have a comment period, of course.
Oh, excuse me.
Melissa, you said it was restricted to what that special meeting was covering.
So special meeting... you don't have to allow public comment.
Right.
OSCW is only for regular meetings.
Special meeting.
Right, so.
But it is an open meeting.
Correct, so we could have the public there, we just are not required to offer public comment.
Correct. Okay. So further basic requirements, meeting agendas must be made available online no later than 24 hours in advance of the meeting. Adjournments and continuances of meetings must comply with particular notice requirements. Any action or vote taken in violation of the OPMA shall be null and void. Potential personal liability for knowingly taking actions in violation of the OPMA. And you're required to have training, which you're having. So what is a public agency? You all are part of a public agency. I'm gonna just cut to the chase. You can read the definition. a governing body, you all. A meeting and an action. A meeting is a meeting at which action is taken. Don't you love those definitions? A meeting is a meeting. Action is the transaction of official business by the governing body, including but not limited to receipt of public testimony, deliberations, discussions, considerations, review, evaluations, and final actions. And final actions means a collective positive or negative decision or an actual vote by a majority of the members of a governing body. So a meeting does not need to be in person. A meeting can occur via email, via telephone call, via text message. And because you are such a small governing body, it can happen very easily. So anytime two of you communicate outside of this context that you're communicating right now, you could potentially be having a meeting if you are taking any sort of action related to the district's business. So any conversation related to the district's business, any discussion, any review, any consideration. So you want to be very, very, very careful when you have discussions with one another outside of the context of one of these meetings.
But casual conversations about non-district related things, that isn't a violation.
Correct. If you want to talk about grandchildren, that's great.
Okay, well, I mean, I think that that's very reasonable, and I think we've been very careful about that. But if no action is taken, it's still a meeting, right? Even if you have a gathering of members of a public agency and no action is taken, it is still a meeting, correct?
Well, because the definition of action is so broad, yes, it can easily be construed as such. An action is a discussion. If it's any conversation related to district business, it is a meeting.
Okay.
So very easily, the here's a picture of my new grandbaby can transition very easily into something that's discussing district business.
Can I just jump in and say that even though that's not a meeting, if two of you are sharing grandchildren pictures and having a casual conversation, it's the perception.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody saw two of you talking, they could say that you're violating the Public Meetings Act. So it's not that it's not, you can't do it, it's just the perception, and we want to be careful that we're not having conversations about the actual meeting.
Anywhere.
And the other piece of that I want to talk about is text messaging. I'm not sure how much text messaging or emailing goes on between the three of you in personal communications, for example. I see hands waving. What does that mean?
She was saying, No.
It doesn't happen. Okay. I just want to say, because I said before, if just have your personal communications on your personal device, but if you two are having a personal text exchange on your personal devices, and we get a request in that says, I want all communications between any of the commission members, I am going to come to you and say, have you had communications on your personal devices with each other? And if the answer is yes, I'm still going to make you do an affidavit that says these weren't about district business, but it still opens. It's what I call opening Pandora's box. You're still opening the idea that you are potentially engaging in some nefarious conduct that you could be lying about. And it's what Melissa says. It's that public perception. And you all just have to be very careful of that to a degree that none of the rest of us do. Okay, I'm going to switch slides. Okay. Okay, so as we just talked about. So we're going to talk about executive sessions. Common reasons for executive sessions: purchase, sale of land, legal issues, personnel issues. No final action can be taken during an executive session. No voting is permitted. Minutes are not required to be taken. You have to cite the purpose of the executive session to the specific subsection of the RCW on the record and briefly describe the reason in the open public meeting. You have to announce the time and abide by it. If you're going to take extra time, you have to formally extend it on the record. You cannot come back early from an executive session. And an attorney must be present for discussions of litigation or anticipated litigation. So you can't announce that you're going to be discussing litigation and not have your attorney present for the executive session. So the penalties for violating the OPMA: actions taken at a meeting not open to the public and properly noticed are null and void, which we discussed earlier. The personal liability piece: members of a governing body who attend a meeting where action is taken in violation of the OPMA with knowledge of the violations are subject to personal liability. The first violation is $500. The second and subsequent violations are $1,000 each. The agency liability: any person who prevails in an OPMA case is awarded attorney fees and costs. And then finally, it's that potential loss of public trust. So I don't know if you saw the article in the Herald the other day about what happened at that school board meeting that I referenced at the beginning. But what happened was the school board member was on Facebook Messenger during an executive session communicating with a parent group who was aligned with her particular values on the issue and the personnel decision, having communications about how she should vote on the personnel decision. So whether or not she violated the OPMA is a question for the courts, but the public perception of what she did made the front page of the Everett Herald the day after, because somebody immediately went to the newspaper. So that public trust piece is a huge piece of this. So that is the end of my presentation. Are there any lingering questions?
I have none.
Thank you. Great presentation. Great conversation.
Yeah. Please feel free to follow up as necessary. And I am here for you and all of your open government needs.
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, excellent job, Sarah.
It is now 10:38. And the board will recess into executive session to discuss the performance of a public employee under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It is anticipated that the executive session will last approximately 60 minutes and will conclude at 11:38 a.m. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission room at 1:30 p.m.